Hi, I'm Richard, the founder of 10 Adventures, and you're listening to the 10 Adventures podcast. We are more than just a travel company. We are a community of active explorers who have been inspired by the outdoors. Join me as I sit down with real people to talk about their most epic adventures on this incredible planet. Welcome back to the 10 Adventures podcast. A major part of traveling is exploring local foods. Whether it's coffee and pastries in France or a thali plate in India, food is a highlight of traveling. That's why I'm excited to chat food and travel and sustainability with Jim Kane, host of the incredible PBS show, The Food Principle. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Richard. Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited because I never really have thought about food as deeply as you have. And I learned so much just watching the first season of the show. But I want to start with, you know, you spent 20 years using food to connect travelers to the places they went to. And why do you think food is so important to a great travel experience?
Well, thanks for the question. And it's funny, I'm laughing just a little bit because, you know, when you mentioned that you haven't, you know, thought about food as deeply as I have, the funny part about that is I didn't start out thinking deeply about food either. I am not a farmer. I'm not a chef. I'm not an artisan food producer. As you mentioned, I spent 20 years, you know, connecting travelers with local culture around the world through trips, through trip design. And before I dive in the food component of that, I'll just, you know, basically say this: the inspiration for creating that company, my old company, Culture Explorers, was the fact that I'd lived outside the U.S. in five different countries for, you know, intermediate amounts of time, living and working and studying. And when it came time for me to start a business, I thought of the special connections that I had made in that time abroad, and I knew that not everyone, you know, has the ability to make that choice or wants to make that choice. So I thought, how could I, you know, sort of provide some glimpses and a slice of life experience to travelers who just have a week or two in a destination, but try to, how do I take them below the surface in ways that I, you know, was able to experience life abroad, living abroad. So when I thought about ways to connect travelers in sort of genuine, you know, engaging, natural ways, a few things came to mind, right? Local festivals that are fantastic and colorful and kind of make you dive right in. Arts and crafts traditions in a lot of countries that we went to. And food. And that was how, you know, I first started delving into food. It was this great way to, you know, break down barriers immediately, this invitation to local life that's accessible to everyone. And that's how it started first, you know, first around the table. And then as I had more of these experiences, as I studied it, looked into it, investigated more, I started to get into this rabbit hole of food where I started to understand, you know, wow, food can help us understand whole ecosystems around the places we're traveling. It can help us understand, you know, the history of immigration to these places and how that's, you know, how we can look at immigration through food influences in a place. You know, I started to understand, you know, and think about issues of biodiversity and habitat and bigger and bigger. So it came really gradually, step by step, but it started and it still is that amazing invitation to conversation, an invitation to empathy, an invitation to a connection that you can't get in almost any other way.
And I know, you know, some people dive right in when they're on holiday. They try everything and anything. But some people struggle to explore the food as they travel, and they come back, you know, often maybe never even experienced. You know, my dad went to India and he talks about having the spaghetti bolognese at one Hyatt and the club sandwich at another place. And he did not try the food in 2 weeks in India. Do you have some tips for how to get the best experience and taste, you know, the best of a country?
You know, I'll try to think of a few. There's so many ways to go about it. And there are different comfort levels for different people, like you're mentioning your dad in India. One, I know that India is one of the places that I have yet to visit. I'm just dying to. But I know a lot of people are warned about, watch out for street food or be careful with the foods you eat, whenever, wherever they're going, whether it's India or elsewhere. So I think that unfortunately kind of dampens the enthusiasm for folks to try something new or outside their comfort zone. But I think there's a lot of ways. There's a lot of ways you can do it. One of my favorite things to do in any destination I travel to, and it's accessible to everyone, is go to the local food market. Even if you're not trying the foods at the market, which is something I would definitely recommend doing. But if your comfort zone is such that you're not quite there, even just delving in, experiencing the sounds and the sights and the smells and the colors and the conversations and the hustle and bustle is one of, the best ways to dive into a local culture. Taking a cooking class, that's something that's become incredibly popular over the last couple of decades. And that's one way in which you could sort of take care of those, maybe hygiene and safety concerns that you might have, let's say, instead of trying something in a local market that might not be washed appropriately or whatever. Going to a cooking class with a professional in country or someone, maybe not their professional chef, but someone who's been doing this for travelers and for others for a long time, you can kind of put yourself at ease with the safety and hygiene concerns and also, get into deeper conversations. Sometimes these places are done in professional, studios or kitchens. Sometimes they're done in people's homes. I've had cooking class in people's homes and you get this incredible insight into, daily life. You'll see their kids' pictures on the wall. You'll see how they live, how their furniture's set up, what kind of posters or art they have on the wall. And you can have, again, a million conversations thanks to this bridge that food is. I know I'm going a little bit deep into a couple of the experiences, but there's so many ways. I know, listen, your podcast, 10 Adventures, it's one of the misconceptions I think about food travel from a lot of people that just, hear in the media, read about maybe fancy restaurants or Michelin-starred places. You hear a lot about destination travel for food in terms of the high-end restaurants. And while that's great for people that want to experience it, I have once in a while, I think it's a thrill. But much more than that, food can be incorporated into active adventures for anybody. And I emphasize the term active because we talked about going to a local market, of course, but you can also do things with food. Let's say you're a hiker. You want to go hiking in Switzerland or in Catalonia in Spain or wherever. There's a great experience that I've had, for instance, in Catalonia, where I've gone out with a gastrobotanist, basically a person specializing in edible plants and flowers, right? And we go on a beautiful nature hike along the Cap de Creus, but we're exploring and tasting and learning about, local flora and fauna through this edible walk through the forest. And so it adds another layer of experience. And I can multiply this in so many ways, on land, on water. You can go out. There's in Denmark, there are things called oyster sauce, where you can go in the low tide into the oyster mud flats in northern Denmark and go out and scoop up and shuck, your own oyster lunch and learn about the invasive species. You can learn about the native species of oyster, its seasons, how oysters filter water. You're just adding layers and layers and layers to what would otherwise be a cool nature experience. But by adding food into the mix or weaving food into the mix, it just deepens it, I think.
Jim, I loved how you mentioned all those experiences, and I've done all of them. And one thing I realized when you're talking is the connection that you have on these cooking, you learn to cook a local dish because you spend a couple hours with people you don't know, and quickly you get beyond the rudimentary. You start understanding how our, you know, lives are similar and how we're, you know, even though we live across the other side of the world, we have so many similarities. And in the first season of The Food Principle, which is incredible, by the way, you talk about this and how food's so important for conservation, connection, and community. And, you know, your story just brought it home. But can you maybe talk a little bit more about how food brings conservation, connection, and community together?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for the question. It's an important one. It's a broad one. So I'll try to see if I can wrap it all together. But you mentioned, you know, let's start off with the community part, because that you mentioned, you know, an experience in someone's home. And one thing I think about a lot is food, especially the sharing of food. It's an intimate act. And when you're traveling to another place where maybe you don't know the language or the cultures are very different, there are very few other ways in which to break that barrier and get into, you know, a place of intimacy and sharing in that way. So I think in terms of community, in terms of travel and feeling and being part of the community, that's one way to think about it. I'm going to go back, Richard, and think about an event that I pulled together a few years ago here in Kansas City, because you asked about conservation, connection, and community. And while you can touch upon, I think, parts of that in different experiences around food, I pulled together an event a few years ago back in Kansas City that I think brought it all together. It was called Peru Meets the Prairie. And during the time of my trip design, I had found this incredible NGO in the remote Andes of Peru called Por Eso that were doing community vegetable gardens and greenhouses in communities that had, you know, malnutrition. I also got to know some incredible chefs in Lima. And then, of course, I'm here in Kansas City. And so I thought, how can I bring an experience that could involve chefs from Kansas City, chefs from Peru, the people in my community of Kansas City to learn about the culture of Peru through food and make a positive impact for an organization that I've fallen in love with all at the same time. So we did a week-long cultural and culinary exchange. We brought up two chefs from two of the best restaurants in Peru. We had them work with four chefs here in Kansas City. And each night, we had a different event. One night it was a street festival with street foods and music from Peru and Kansas City. Another night it was all about seafood with, again, chefs from Kansas City and Peru preparing it. And then we had a final dinner. We had a farm lunch activity. It was, you know, brought the kids and it was great. Barbecue from Kansas City. And then we had a final dinner where each of the chefs prepared one dish as sort of a tasting menu finale. But the purpose of all this was to raise money for this amazing organization in Peru, Por Eso. So the event brought together, it ended up raising almost $11,000 for the organization. But at every step of the equation, chefs from Peru exchanged and bonded with chefs from Kansas City. The community came out, and whether they were dancing and eating street food one night or sitting down and admiring the high-end dinner or going out with their kids to the farm and enjoying the tour of the farm, they were connecting. They were being part of a greater community through food. And in terms of conservation, in this case, the example with the vegetable gardens and the greenhouses in the Andes, it's maybe more of a social impact than a natural conservation conversation. But when I think about that conservation and sustainability, it's the power of food to make positive changes in our life, you know? And a lot of times that revolves around conservation of natural resources. In this case, that revolved around sustaining of a community in the remote Andes. So kind of a long answer to a short question, but that's one of the projects that I think brought it all together, and one of the projects I remain, you know, most proud about in my professional life.
It sounds incredible. You've got to take that concept on the road. I could only imagine a week of like Peruvian chefs making great stuff here in Western Canada. Like it's something you can't, you know, you get authentic food, authentic culture. I love that idea. That leads to one episode which I was really interested in, and it educated me. I've never heard of this word, Samfundssind, and I'm sure I've said it wrong, but it's all about what's going on in Copenhagen. And can you maybe explain this concept? Because it really resonated with me.
Yeah, sure. So I'm probably not pronouncing it perfectly either. Danish is really hard to pronounce, but I think it's Samfundssind, to the best of my knowledge of Danish friends correcting me. But the idea was when for season one, it was just when life had opened up post-pandemic in 2021. And I was researching Denmark. We were going to go over there to film. And I came across this word, and it came up. The reason I mentioned the pandemic is because it came up during the pandemic in Denmark. It's an old Danish word, but it was sort of resurrected during the pandemic. And what it signified was this idea of social consciousness or social mindedness. And again, in the context of the pandemic, that's how it was used. But I also, having read about the New Nordic Manifesto from 2004, which was this chef's manifesto about how to interact with your environment and food and farmers and your suppliers. Samfundssind seemed to ring a bell in terms of what the Danes are doing really well in their society. And I wanted to examine that through stories of food and the people, that are doing this through food to create this idea of community spirit and community mindedness. So that's what we did. That's what we did with a thought in mind. So I talked to Klaus Meyer, the co-founder of NOMA and architect of this, one of the architects of this New Nordic Manifesto. But I really had him introduce me to a couple of his proteges, because he had a couple of incredible women that were doing projects around the world. One was in Brownsville, New York. One was in Bolivia, in terms of using food for social impact. And then they had both come back to Copenhagen, and they were running a restaurant which incorporated that philosophy of community mindedness or community spirit, especially in terms of the sustainability of the workers at the restaurant. Restaurants are notoriously they're a notorious grind. A lot of times, they really chew people up and spit people out in terms of the industry. It's a hard place to make a career without burning out. So this restaurant, Lola, did a couple of things. One, they really put an emphasis not only on the sustainable supply of their food, but in the sustainability of their own people working at the restaurant. Life-work balance, mental health, assistance for those that needed, reasonable work hours and things like that. And then they had another project called Lola Impact, which is a street food stall where they took people who had either been formerly incarcerated or at the margins of society, who were having a hard time integrating back into society, and they taught them culinary skills in the food truck. They taught them responsibility, and how to show up on time for a job, and sort of used food to reintegrate people into society. So that was one of the examples and one of the stories we told in the Food Principle in Denmark.
Hey everyone, this is Richard, and I just want to take 30 seconds to let you know that if you are enjoying these stories and are interested in embarking on your own adventure, then head over to 10adventures.com. At 10 Adventures, our specialty is booking private and custom active holidays. Jump straight from dreaming to doing without any of the hassle of travel planning in between. Join thousands of other travelers who have already booked with 10 Adventures to destinations in over 85 countries and experience more of what our planet has to offer while making memories that'll last a lifetime. Now back to the podcast. Well, I'm interested, in one of the Appalachia episodes, there was also the use of food to help people who had drug addictions, or I think incarcerated as well, kind of come back into society. There's some really powerful statements by some of the people you talk to. Why do you think food is used to help people kind of get their life together?
That episode, and I appreciate you bringing it up, because it's before filming in Appalachia, I had actually never traveled through the region, even though, I'm here in the States. But it's a region that I've read about a lot, but had never really experienced firsthand. And that episode in particular, you know, was about the theme of food as a tool for healing and recovery. And the example you're mentioning was really powerful. It was a brick oven bakery that basically hired... You have to understand the context of Appalachia a little bit first, because it's a really specific, it's specific to its place and its context. Of course, this is a region with incredibly rich natural resources, but it's been exploited and sort of, you know, excavated, and everything's been sort of sucked out of Appalachia for a lot of years. So with the decline of the coal industry, the opioid crisis in Appalachia is one of the most acute in the United States, and one of the most acute regions in the United States for the opioid crisis. So that was the solution, or that was the problem that Gwen, the baker, was trying to solve for. Because of this opioid addiction crisis, a lot of people are ending up in jail just because they were addicted to opioids. So when they would come out, Gwen would hire formerly incarcerated opioid addicts at her bakery as a way of, you know, bringing people together. And what I found was it wasn't just, you know, a way to keep their hands busy in a useful way, a way to feel responsible and productive in society. But each of the people that I talked to that had been through prison and had come out and were working at the bakery, talked about the new family they had, the community that had formed, you know, around the bakery, of people that were supporting them. Because in their life before, when they were addicted to opioids, they were traveling with folks that also had addictions. No one could be counted on. They never knew when their friends were going to go away or go to jail, or you know, when someone will betray someone else because of their addiction. But in the bakery, they found a new family that was supportive of their new life, and they found strength in that community and that support. And again, I think you asked, you know, why food is such a powerful tool for this. And there are other examples that we haven't yet filmed. There's a pizzeria in Philadelphia called Down North that hires formerly incarcerated. But I think there's a couple of reasons why food is so useful for that. Camilla Seidler, one of the chefs we worked with in Copenhagen, was explaining this as well. In her restaurant, you can enter the food system or enter the restaurant system or the food preparation system at any level. So even if you have zero training and zero experience with that background, you know, you can chop carrots, you can clean and peel potatoes, you can do some of the prep work in a kitchen right away. And then if you have the desire to advance, or you have other experiences that would put you in a different position, there are all kinds of levels and opportunities in the service industry and in the food industry, and even beyond restaurants, you know, going out and I haven't filmed this, but there's certainly programs that I've read about with people that used to be in the military that have PTSD that are now farming and finding healing and recovery in that process of farming. One of the guests that we spoke to, an elder, a Cherokee elder, Amy Walker in the Appalachia episode, found that same type of healing in farming. She had been pulled away from her cultural roots as a child and found this healing and sense of reclamation and recovery as an older adult through farming on her sacred land.
I want to switch gears, because the show also talks a lot about sustainability and health and uses food as the entry point to that. And I noticed that people who have no interest in sustainability and health from the outside all of a sudden are interested in, they only want grass-fed beef or they only want organic vegetables. And they're starting to approach these things, not for any kind of ethical or other reasons, just it tastes better. But I'm interested in why you think food is such a powerful way to talk about sustainability and health.
Yeah, well, thanks. It's another big question. You know, I think that those are such big issues, right? And what I want to stress about sustainability and health is that people can, it's a continuum, and people can take steps along the way. So I'm not advocating, or I might give examples, but I don't want to be confused for advocating a certain diet or a certain recommendation for how you should eat or what you should avoid. But I think the more we understand about our food system, the more it can inform our decisions to maybe moderate or make small adjustments in our diets to improve not only our own health, but the planet's health. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The beef industry, writ large, is responsible, from what I've read, for 40% of all deforestation on Earth, including 80% of the deforestation in the Amazon. Soy that goes hand in hand with that, and I say goes hand in hand with that because 70% of soy production in the world is used for animal feed. That also destroys natural habitat, mostly in tropical areas that are, you know, helping regulate climate change and everything else. So without those forests or tropical areas, it's getting worse. You can go through the list on water, fisheries. 30% of the world's fisheries are overfished, and so there's declining stocks. But I think instead of saying, okay, you know, I'm going to eliminate all beef, or I'm going to eliminate all fish, or whatever it might be, more what I'm saying is, if you have an understanding of this, you might do like we do in our household, which is, you know, cut down on red meat and only save it for, you know, dad's awesome, you know, grilled burgers once in a while, or mom's awesome, you know, bolognese sauce. Sure, we'll make exceptions for that, but we cut it. We've cut way back on our red meat consumption. It happens to be healthier, according to almost every study I've read, and it's making a step in the right direction for the planet. But I think those things are incredibly important. The only thing I would stress again is I would want to stay away from, because I think it's intimidating when people feel like someone is advocating for an all or none, or saying, you know, do this and not that. And these black and white scenarios, I think can be counterproductive in people's understanding and creating behavior change. But I think if people can think about it on a spectrum, the more they understand about food systems and what's healthy for the planet is oftentimes healthy for people. And if they can just move, step by step in that direction, I think it'll be good for both.
Yeah, no, there's a similar comment on one of the episodes that was, you know, that exact same idea that what's good for us individually is also good for the planet. And again, often, you know, fresh local food. I spent all my summers on a farm. Having something right out of the ground, like if you've had vegetables that are right out of the ground, it is incredible. Like fried potatoes that have just been pulled out of the ground is like one of the most incredible things. And most people never get to taste that because they'll buy the frozen fried potatoes, or they're buying potatoes that were in storage for 4 months. And I always worry we're losing this connection with, you know, the farmers and the farms and this kind of industrialization of food, and we don't remember how good, like a fresh salad that's just been picked, those leaves are out of this world. And then most of us buy the plastic salad bags, and we're almost losing what food should taste like. And especially when you go more regional, you have one episode where they show the different types of corn, which I thought was real. I've never, you know, my grandfather had a corn farm. I'd never seen that type of corn before. I was kind of blown away. And then you find out, oh, it's better for hurricanes. You know, it's the only corn that withstands the crazy local weather. I thought that was really interesting.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that diversity is actually, whether it's, you know, in our societies culturally or in nature, it enriches the ecosystem. And that episode with David Bauer he's a miller down in North Carolina. He is working with farmers in his area to bring back these heritage corn crops, a lot of which started out with Cherokee and other indigenous tribes that were around that area. They were the original stewards of these heritage crops, but he's bringing a lot of them back. And it turns out they're more delicious. It turns out they're more resistant to things like floods and extreme weather. So there's all kinds of benefits. I'm actually preparing to go and film for season two coming up in the next few months. And in July, I'm going to be going to Ghana, and we're going to be looking at this ancient African grain called fonio that is not only it has the ability to increase people's health. It's more nutritionally dense than some of the Western grains that they've been importing, like corn and wheat. But this grain fonio is not only more nutritionally dense, it's also culturally important. It's been cultivated for 7,000 years in Africa. It's also more drought resistant. And this is an area in the Sahel in Africa that is becoming, it's at risk of desertification from the Sahara. So it's drought resistant. And it helps small stakeholder farmers, most of which are women, in terms of, you know, equity and inclusion and economic empowerment. So, it's, you can kind of see how, you know, I've gone down this rabbit hole, because the deeper you go, you start with something, oh, this nutritious grain, that's great. What's that about? But then the more layers you peel off and the more you look, you know, the more there is to it. So you get into cultural, you know, richness, you get into the biodiversity. We started out with that, the biodiversity, by incorporating fonio and some of these ancient grains. It's enriching the soil, and you know, it's creating more food sovereignty. There's all kinds of benefits to it.
And you know, one of the threats, and it was mentioned in one of the episodes, is all this, you know, regional diversity of food. One of the threats is just, you know, these big food brands that come in and replace the mom and pop shops with, you know, a Starbucks, an Arby's, a BK. I remember when I used to live in London, we had this great Italian old man. He had a little coffee shop, and I think a cappuccino was 90p, and he had a friend who had, you know, great Italian pastries. And then Starbucks opened up across the way, and within a year his business had shut down. And it was just, you know, you see again these great little local businesses that they lose out because they don't have the financial power. Should we be more worried about this impact of big brands kind of commoditizing food, so you get the same experience in every city? You know, see, every major city seemingly around the world has almost the same brands.
You know, I think we should be aware of it, and I think we should try to support, again, that diversity. There are stories, there are hopeful stories, and I think there are positive stories. In our day and age, I think there's more awareness and more eagerness to try things that are unique as well. I'll give you a positive story here in Kansas City that goes to what you were talking about with Starbucks. You're right. You know, while Starbucks did put out a lot of mom and pops and local when they expanded, here in Kansas City, there's a local roaster that I adore called Broadway Roasting Company, and they have a cafe associated. And I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, Starbucks opened up right next door to Broadway. And it was like, oh my God, they're going to put them out of business. You know, one of Kansas City's best, oldest, you know, most amazing roasters. And a couple years went by and a store closed. Do you want to guess which it was?
It was the Starbucks.
It was the Starbucks on the corner. It was unbelievable. And it showed that there was, you know, I have nothing against Starbucks. I mean, Starbucks, I think, does try to do, you know, things in their own way. And on a global scale, they can do things that a local roaster can't, in terms of maybe supporting certain farming communities and philanthropy on a larger scale. But in terms of that diversity and the artisan success story, I mean, and Broadway, you know, made them close shop, and they're still around. This is 10 years later. And John Cates, who's this incredible artisan, one of the best in the United States, is still doing his thing at a local shop in Kansas City. He didn't want to expand or make Broadway a chain. He's still just producing some of the best coffee and having the best direct relationships with farmers of anyone here in the United States. So I think we need to, one, recognize and celebrate that there are some examples of artisans, you know, winning battles. We haven't won the war necessarily, but they're winning battles. And I would just say, as folks are looking to travel and experience new places, that why do we go to other places? I think it's for to experience things that are different from, you know, our life at home. And so I think, as you would, I would stress just, you know, you look for that, you know, local producer, go to that local mom and pop, go to find out what are the seasonal indigenous crops that are growing in that area and what foods are they producing from them. And then go explore it at your, in your own way, at your own pace. But yeah, you're going to have a much richer experience in the end.
So Jim, I can't let you go. You know, you have this deep understanding of food and travel. If there are people thinking, oh, I want to go to some place that's going to be great, but also have a really powerful food scene, what are some destinations people can, you know, they may not think about as being something that's going to really reward, you know, people that love great food or, you know, great wine?
Yeah, I would mention, if you listen, you know, of course, you start to get, the more I think about it, probably the more places I could mention, but I'll keep it to a few. I would say that one of the first places I think about is Peru. Peru has an incredibly deep living culture, but also a remarkable food culture. It's one of the most biodiverse places on Earth, and it has this extreme altitude difference. You know, you get ecosystems from desert coast to the Amazon to the high Andean lakes. And so you get all these incredible ecosystems, and you have layers of migration that have each layer of migration has influenced the food culture. So Peru would be one of my top choices in the world. A place that I just experienced recently, Richard, was Japan, as you and I both experienced some amazing things in Japan. I fell in love with Japanese food culture. I brought my family before the summit that we both attended. I brought my family and we traveled in Tokyo and Kyoto. And my son loved it as much as my wife and I did, you know, whether it was the ramen shops that we would, you know, we would try with a local friend from Tokyo, or whether it was, you know, the kaiseki meal in Kyoto. So Japan would be one. You mentioned Copenhagen and Denmark. That has become an incredible hub for energy in all parts of the food system, not just restaurants, but a lot of creatives are in Copenhagen right now working on big food problems, how to have a more circular economy through food, how to do regenerative ocean farming, and gentle fishing techniques that aren't going to, you know, scrape up and ruin the ocean beds. So I think Denmark and Copenhagen is one of my top choices. And then, you know, going back, I'll shout out a couple things in the U.S. I think Appalachian food culture is incredible. I mean, I experienced things when I was filming in Appalachia that I, you know, never would have imagined. So it is one of those areas where the more time you give me, the more places I'll mention, because every place has, that's what makes food so great. You can't, each place that you go is special in its own way, because it relates to, you know, when you have those conversations that are invited into that, you know, understanding and empathy through food, you understand that each place has its traditional foods. Each place has its rituals. And as you understand those, I think the food tastes even better.
What a great way to end this chat, Jim. I want to say thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I hope I haven't talked your ear off too much. I have a tendency, but it's something I love to share and think about together with others. So thanks.
I know I've loved talking food and travel, and it's funny, as I get older, the food becomes almost as important as everything else. And it's like, oh yeah, we're gonna have great meals for like 2 or 3 weeks, and we're gonna eat food we can't eat here in Western Canada. So also, the show is a great show. If people want to watch The Food Principle, where can they find it?
Sure. Well, I think the easiest way is just to go onto YouTube, and there's a PBS food channel. PBS is, of course, the public television in the US, but they have a PBS food YouTube channel. And The Food Principle is one of the shows that's streaming there for free. and worldwide.
Excellent. I'll put links to the show channel in the show notes. And with that, thanks for listening to this episode of the 10 Adventures podcast. We'll be back next week to explore the world and hear about more epic adventures. Start planning your own adventure by visiting us at 10adventures.com and listen to other episodes of the 10 Adventures podcast on Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you find your podcasts.